According to a new study by Qualtrics, a software technology company, employees in the United States are combating the soaring prices of essentials like groceries, housing, and gas by looking for ways to increase their incomes and cut down on expenses. The survey of more than 1,000 full-time employees found that 38% of workers have looked for a second job, while another 14% are planning to do so. Qualtrics chief workplace psychologist Dr. Benjamin Granger says, "With budgets tightening, workers are searching for ways to meet the rising cost of living, including finding new jobs." The new opinion poll states working parents are especially pinched, as nearly 70% said their pay isn't keeping up with costs. About 47% of employees with children have looked for a second job, higher than the rate of workers overall. According to a recent Brookings Institution estimate, the cost of raising a child through high school has surged to more than $300,000, up roughly $26,000 from 2 years ago. It's not unusual for American workers to have multiple jobs, especially with more people tapping into the gig economy and doing independently managed work like freelancing or growing a side hustle. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports as of September, 7.8 million Americans are working more than one job, making up 4.9% of the total U.S. workforce. A record 440,000 Americans were working two full-time positions in August, compared to 308,000 in February of 2020. High inflation and easing COVID-19 concerns may be prompting more people to look for seasonal work this winter. At the same time, employers are pulling back from 2021's hot holiday hiring levels and offering fewer incentives to prospective workers. The British newspaper The Daily Mail writes, "Half of Americans say runaway inflation and high living costs are taking a toll on their health, as millions of people turn to drink, junk food and smoking more as worries mount over electricity and gas bills this winter. Research at Toluna, a consumer insights firm, found that 50% of those surveyed were feeling their health suffer as a result of the cost of living crisis, with inflation currently running above 8%, according to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Among them, 37% said they were feeling more stressed, 21% said they were eating less healthily, and 16% said they were smoking more, and 13% were drinking alcohol more often. The survey of 1,000 people comes as inflation, crime and immigration are at the front of voters' minds ahead of the November 8 midterm elections, which will decide whether Republicans or Democrats control Congress. A recent projection by Bloomberg says the U.S. economy was 100% likely to plunge into a recession within the next year. Previously, economists had only estimated a 60% chance of a recession. Matt Booth, a researcher on the survey, said, "As we move further into the cost of living crisis, the impact it is starting to show now." He added, "It's affecting everything from our personal health to how we plan our grocery shopping and where we are cutting back to save money." The opinion poll showed nearly 3/4 of Americans said they were worried by the rising cost of electricity and gas, as consumers face steep increases in prices, heating oil, propane and other fuels in the coming colder months. Nearly 2/3 of those surveyed said the energy crisis and the rising cost of living were affecting their spending plans. Large numbers of respondents said they would cut back on eating, that is 37%, or they would order takeouts, 23%, or buy cheaper items, 21%.
Palestinian women. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%, and the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalists' syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
طابع وطني.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
صعب على فتاة أن تقتحم مجال خصوصا في بلد ساخن.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end, I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big, that I was a mother and studying and working at the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis gives you really courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I say for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training on documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
I
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive. And sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work on all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the government has tested energy blackout emergency plans as supply fears grow this winter. Whitehall officials have wargamed Programme Yarrow, a blueprint for coping with power outages for up to a week. We take a look at some of the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. The government has wargamed emergency plans to cope with energy blackouts lasting up to 7 days in the event of a national power outage amid growing fears over security of supply of energy this winter. The Guardian has seen documents marked official sensitive, which warn that in a reasonable worst-case scenario, all sectors including transport, food and water supply, communications and energy could be severely disrupted for up to a week. They show that ministers will prioritise getting food, water and shelter to the young and elderly people, as well as those with caring responsibilities if the country experiences blackouts, with the Met Office warning that Britain faces a higher risk of a cold winter. Whitehall officials are currently stress-testing Programme Yarrow, the confidential plan for coping in the event of a national power outage, and have held a series of exercises with government departments and councils across the country in recent days. The cross-government blueprint was first drawn up in 2021, before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, to improve planning and resilience in the event of a major technical fault on the national grid. It's unrelated to the energy outlooks published by the National Grid for this winter. However, concerns over the impact of a blackout have grown as a result of the war, with government insiders admitting the planning exercises had taken on a new urgency as a result of the resulting energy crisis, which has seen British household energy bills spike. Ed Miliband, the Shadow Climate Secretary, said, "All governments do contingency planning for worst-case scenarios, but the truth is that we are vulnerable as a country as a direct consequence of a decade of failed conservative energy policy." Banning onshore wind, slashing investment in energy efficiency, stalling nuclear and closing gas storage have led to higher bills and reliance on gas imports, leaving us more exposed to the impact of the geopolitical situation. The type of technical fault envisaged by the government planners include flood damage or a lightning strike on a substation, but could also cover an attack by a hostile state on subsea power cables, following the attack on the Nord Stream energy pipelines. The leak comes after a warning from Tom Tugendhat, the security minister, on Monday that Britain had become more vulnerable in recent years, as countries seeking to do it harm had levelled the field by investing time and money into new technologies. In the worst-case scenario outlined in the plan, only analogue FM radios would work, with just BBC Radio 2 and 4 broadcasting, and uncertainties around local radio, as some stations only have a few hours of backup generator cover. One source has said, "The government doesn't want any publicity on Programme Yarrow, as they don't want it to be seen as linked to Ukraine, energy supply and the cost of living. But we need to think about how we can help people in advance. The fact that they're talking about it now means they have a real concern that it could really happen." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has more on the same story. In Britain, ministers have wargamed emergency plans to cope with week-long blackouts this winter, it has emerged. Government documents marked official sensitive warned that food and water supplies, transport and communications could all be severely disrupted for up to 7 days, in a reasonable worst-case scenario in the event of a national power outage. Whitehall officials are stress-testing Programme Yarrow, the secret plan to cope with blackouts, which includes prioritising getting food, water and shelter to the young and the elderly, as well as those with caring responsibilities, amid fears that the Russia-Ukraine conflict has sparked an energy crisis this winter. The cross-government plan was first drawn up last year, before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, in a bid to improve planning and resilience in the event of a major fault on the national grid. It is understood that the type of technical fault envisaged under the plans includes an attack by a hostile foreign power on underwater power cables, following attacks against the Nord Stream energy pipelines in the Baltic Sea. It comes as the Met Office has warned an increased chance of a colder than usual winter this year, which could put further pressure on gas and electricity supplies. Programme Yarrow prepares for a situation more severe than that outlined by the National Grid last month, which warned of 3-hour rolling blackouts. The plans envisage that 60% of electricity demand will be met between day 2 and day 7, when households and businesses will be given intermittent access to rations supply. Households, businesses will be given 24 hours notice of a planned power outage, and the plan could be published up to a week ahead on a rolling basis. British government documents marked official sensitive have warned that food and water supplies, transport and communications could all be severely disrupted for up to 7 days, in a reasonable worst-case scenario in the event of a national power outage.
Hidden Files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugar cane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American European Front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule during a time when slavery was the norm in many countries. Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that, for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is the longest, one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. And you have to, so you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? It's, if you, your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative, met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which that, which plan, the plan succeeded in February 2004, the year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so, so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep, deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protests, set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that Black people, these Black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, there's you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he said, he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the Blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the Blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think ever, you know, so if you see that and then you've seen all the WikiLeaks files which were released and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, I mean, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war. So a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group, the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States. And they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in, you know, in Libya and Algeria and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. You know, for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back, that you have this coup d'etat. I mean, to be fair, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? The paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very... The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't stay that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if it was like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia. But the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the UN to get out. They want the US to remove